But before we get into the great work you've done in the movie with Caesar's Messiah, can you tell us a little bit about your background before becoming a scholar and an author and a movie producer now?
Yeah, I mean, basically I have no background whatsoever in this particular field. What really sort of brought me into it in hindsight was the fact that I grew up in Japan and attended a kind of strange school, a Jesuit military academy, because this was the only school that was accessible to me, that spoke English, for example, nearby. And so I went there for years, and the pedagogy was strange. It was really very focused on the Gospels and Christianity. These were Jesuits who were pretty fundamental in their beliefs and how they approach Christianity. And so I would study it every day, basically. It was just part of my world. And when I became older, I drifted away from the faith. It just, you know, wasn't in my world. I didn't have some sort of big negative reaction to Christianity. I just wasn't connected to it and just sort of stopped, you know, at a very young age. I really was just not interested in it. But I always retained the curiosity about the Jesus character because I'd had so much study, you know, of the Gospels and of just Christianity in general. And then later on, I noticed the controversy that had emerged about the Dead Sea Scrolls, that people were confused as to why, after 35 years, they wouldn't release some of them. And there were quite a few paranoid rumors about why they weren't releasing this material. And so I was curious about that and looked into the scrolls, just started reading about them as a general hobby. And what I found, it sort of amazed me, because it clearly described, the scrolls described, a messianic cult in Judea at approximately the same time that the Christian cult purportedly was wandering around. And yet this group was militaristic, wanted to drive the Romans out of Judea. Their Christ would have been a warrior like David, sort of the original anointed king of the Jews. And so that really confused me. I was confused why this group isn't mentioned in the Gospels. And I was also confused as to how Christians could have come into existence, the Christians that we're familiar with, at a time when Judea was a war zone. The looking into the Gospels sort of required me to look at the history of the first century, and that's when I really started to have doubts about the historical nature of Jesus Christ. And what I saw was an area that was occupied by Rome that contained a messianic movement that was militaristic and fought against Rome. In fact, was completely successful at certain points and drove the Roman legions out. So therefore, it was obviously the national messianic movement, but would never have permitted a kind of Christian messianic movement. They would have seen the character of Jesus Christ as blasphemous. So I was just curious about all this, and if you want to take your understanding to a more informed place of the Gospels, to a more informed place, you've really got to study this guy named Flavius Josephus, because he was the only person that actually wrote a history of this era of Judea. So there's no other on-the-ground individual who's writing the history of the first century of Judea other than this guy Flavius Josephus. And so I started studying his history, and it was then that I noticed that there were a number of very strange parallels between events described in the Gospels and events described in the military campaign that this particular Roman Caesar named Titus Flavius had. And so at a certain point, I just started studying that relationship. I was curious about what these parallels in Josephus really meant. And one day I, you know, after having kind of looked at quite a number of them, I noticed an odd thing. I noticed that they were all occurring in the same sequence, both in the Gospels and in the history of the war. And so that led me to realize that the whole ministry of Jesus had been invented. It was based on the military campaign. The ministry of Jesus, you know, is wandering around Galilee and is going into Jerusalem and then eventually his crucifixion. All of these were actually stories that had been developed from prior stories. And so it became pretty obvious that the character Jesus Christ was a fictional one and that he had been invented for political purposes. In other words, the Romans wanted to have an alternative messianic movement that could exist in the empire, and so they came up with this pacifistic turn the other cheek, give to Caesar what is Caesar's Messiah, and just attempted to develop a religion around him, and eventually they were successful.
What role would Josephus play in forming this role in Christianity in Rome? He's basically labeled as the Jewish historian. Where was he from?
Well, I think actually he was a fictional character like Jesus, but the history that he gives is really extremely unusual. He claims to have been born into the royal family of the Jews, the Maccabees. He claims to have, as a young man, been a member at different times of all three major sects that he describes of the Jews. So he had the vast theological background. He claims to have been a child prodigy, that he was dazzling people with his intellectual capacities when he was 12 years old. And then when the rebellion against Rome broke out in 66, he claims that they made him a general of the forces in Galilee. Now, according to Josephus, he was captured by the Romans. He had a divine inspiration at that point. God had a communication with him and told him that the old covenant between God and the Jews was broken, and a new covenant between God and the Romans was going to take its place. So he then went to the head Flavian generals, a guy named Vespasian, and he said, you know, I had this communication with God, and he also explained that Vespasian would become the Caesar. At that time, Vespasian was just a general. And so when this came about, when Vespasian, by some miracle, actually became Caesar, they then claimed to have looked upon Josephus as a prophet, someone who had this connection to God, and they adopted him. So now this character, Flavius Josephus, who starts out as a fundamentally religious Jewish person in Judea, ends up living in the Roman imperial court, as an adopted member of the imperial family. They'd given him a big apartment in their palace, and they give him funding, and he writes the history of the war. So that's the story of Josephus, which I think is just cockamamie, but it's what we've been given. The fact is that from the very beginning, from the absolute beginning, people have always known that there was a connection between Josephus's history and the Gospels. In fact, you know, people like St. Augustine and Eusebius, I don't know if you know who they are, but they were, you know, the very first Christian theologians, and they all said the same thing. They said that the prophecies of Jesus, we know, were true prophecies because the historian Josephus recorded that the very events that Jesus predicted came to pass in the history that Josephus recorded. So from the very beginning, Josephus was wired into the Gospels. In fact, in many of the very oldest versions of the Gospels we have, Josephus's work are actually attached to them like kind of a fifth book, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Josephus. And this was because they were the fulfillment. They recorded the fulfillment of Jesus's prophecies. So, you know, so from the very beginning, you've got this connection of the Gospels directly into this Flavian family's imperial court. And this is just very, very suspicious, because this family, the Flavians, who became Caesars and in my opinion, produced the Gospels, all of the prophecies that Jesus makes, or most of the prophecies that Jesus makes, are about their military victories. Jesus says Galilee will be crushed. He names these particular cities that are going to be ruined. He says that Jerusalem is going to be encircled with a wall. I mean, he predicts this. He predicts the temple is going to be raised, not one stone atop another. He predicts that this terrible thing that Daniel foresaw, called the abomination of desolation, is going to come about. Well, all of these things are military victories. They did all come to pass, and they were all military victories of the Flavian Caesars. So the victors write history. This is understood by everyone at this point. And in the case of the Gospels, to the extent they're history, they're simply a prophecy of military victories, not a history. But they are known to have been written after the war, because there are events, everyone agrees, in the war that are recorded within them as predictions. And so, frankly, I'm always amazed that people look at my understanding of the Gospels, my interpretation, with shock, because frankly, it's just the very most routine way to interpret the Gospels, that they're a recording of military victories done by the victors.
Yeah. So in a sense, this would be the version of the Roman Empire in the Old Testament would be of the Israel of the East. So this was the new version, basically taken over by Rome.
Yeah,
and they incorporated
exactly.
it into their government.
They wanted to have a version of Judaism that was compatible with the Roman Empire. And this wasn't some sort of brand new technique that only happened, you know, this one time with Christianity. This was the routine stuff that the Caesars did. In fact, when the character Vespasian, or the soon-to-be emperor, he's a true historical individual, when Vespasian learned that he'd become Caesar, he was in Alexandria, Egypt, and so he went into the temple of Serapis to pray, supposedly, and while he was there, Serapis had a divine communication with him. Serapis was a local, powerful, Egyptian god at the time, and Vespasian comes out of the temple, and he goes, you know, I am Serapis. I'm the new Serapis. Serapis has entered into me and I've become Serapis. I'm the new Serapis. And then he works a couple miracles. He cures a withered arm and he makes a blind man see. So, you know, it was just a routine political operation for the Caesars to take on the identity of local gods. And it was an old technique before the Roman Empire. Being when the Ptolemies took over Egypt, they became the Ra. They became the Pharaoh, and you've got all this their sarcophagus is of a Greek Pharaoh with a Greek style beard, and this is just the normal way that rulers would operate against their colonies, because they when you colonize another people. It's a handy thing to try to absorb the religion, because the religion is a point of control. The religion is a point that they can use to have some sway with the population. And so when Vespasian became Caesar, he becomes the new Serapis. But now when they conquered Judea a few years later, the idea that they would adopt the identity of the Christ would just be routine. And this, of course, goes to the major character in the Gospels. I mean, a lot of people think that the most important character in the Gospels is Jesus Christ, but he's really not. The most important character is the individual that Jesus predicts. Jesus says the Son of Man is going to come, and he's the one who has all of the majesty and the power, and he's going to do all these terrible things. All of Jesus's apocalyptic visions, the Galilean towns getting crushed, Jerusalem encircled, et cetera, these are things that he says are going to happen when the Son of Man comes to Judea, when the visitation is made by this badass guy. So the question is really, well, who is the Son of Man, right? Who is this individual Jesus is predicting? It's literally a puzzle in the Gospels. And the way you can answer it is by looking at the time that Jesus indicates the individual will come within, which is 40 years. He says that the guy is going to come before the generation listening to my words passes away, and a generation is 40 years to the Jews of the era. He lists the events that will occur, and these are all the events of the war. And so the war is exactly 40 years from Jesus' ministry. In fact, in almost an absurdity, the date of Jesus' crucifixion is Passover 33, and the war concludes at 73 on Passover. So exactly 40 years to the day from the conclusion of Jesus' ministry, you have the end of the war. So this is obviously something that's created in hindsight was done to just give a little, mystical veneer to this Jewish religion that the fake Jewish religion the Romans were developing. And so, but it shows completely the identity of the Son of Man. I mean, the Son of Man that Jesus is predicting is simply, obviously, the Roman Caesar who comes and does the stuff that Jesus predicts. And in the case of the Son of Man in the Gospels, it's just ridiculous because Titus Flavius claimed to be the Jewish Christ. His court historians, every one of them, Tacitus, Suetonius, Dio, every one of his historians said that the Jewish prophecies that supposedly saw this messianic world ruler actually foresaw the Flavian Caesar, right? So this simply, it just literally can't be any clearer in my mind. The Son of Man that Jesus is envisioning can only be one individual. There's only one person that can possibly claim to have these historical attributes, the attributes that Jesus envisions. And that individual claimed to be the Jewish Christ, and that individual would have had a political motivation for developing Christianity. They were sick of wasting money on these rebellions. So it's really very, my theory receives a lot of shock when people come across it. I've always, frankly, seen this as strange because it's really the most obvious way to understand the Gospels. It's the simplest, easiest way to read the text. It produces a very clear translation. The translation fits right into history and all of the events that we know about the era. And frankly, there's nobody else it could have been but this individual as far as, who was the Son of Man Jesus predicted? Well, he was the Roman Caesar. End of story.
Yeah, and that's what I think people out there that might not understand the history that coincides with the Bible, that, the Romans were the inventors of the Christian religion, and at one time there was only one religion, and that was, Roman Catholicism, and then everybody else was literally a Jew if you weren't part of that religion.
Right.
And also,
what happens is Rome makes it the state religion, and so that's just, that's what it was. And when it became the state religion, though, it was, it was an operation. Rome made it as the state religion for a political purpose, just as though they invented it for a political purpose when they decided to make it the state religion. They had an obvious political purpose in back of that.
Yeah, and in the ancient Roman Empire, the Caesars were held up as gods to the people, and part of that was worshiping them.
That's
and,
right. Yeah.
And some
so
people don't understand.
What happens with Christianity becoming the state religion is that the Caesars were just tired of the rebellions, and so they decided that that a better approach would be to make Christianity the state religion, and in that way, the Pontiff Maximus, or the Pope, could operate as Caesar, but he wouldn't be operating as a secular conquering kind of warmonger. He would be operating as the minister of Jesus Christ. And but the fact is that the title Pontiff Maximus is the title that Caesar held for hundreds of years. It just means the head of the Roman College of Priests. And the Vatican is located on the very hill that the Flavian Caesars had their palace upon. When Constantine makes it the state religion, and he actually didn't make it the state religion, he just began the process of making it the state religion. Constantine just started to use military force to put Christian churches into place and to start shutting down other churches. But he started the process by which the Christian church had the military in back of it. Well, Constantine gets all this positive legacy for bringing us out of paganism, supposedly. But the fact is that the edicts that he issued to start Christianity as a state religion were part of a whole collection of edicts. And all of the other edicts were designed to bring about what became the feudal system. The feudal system is a system of slavery. The word serf, and the serf was the primary component of the feudal system. He was the peasant that did all the work. The word serf means slave. And Constantine set up all these edicts against free landowning farmers so that they couldn't own land any longer. They couldn't change vocation. They couldn't leave the land, and their children could be sold, right? They were just turned into complete slaves. Now, in addition to that, he begins to make Christianity the state religion. And so when you look at the edicts as a collection, then suddenly what Constantine is doing is obvious. Christianity was just put into place as a psychops to prevent rebellion by the serfs, the slaves, because instead of Caesar being the one telling them what to do, it was the Pontiff Maximus. In other words, it was just Caesar with another name. But you wouldn't rebel from this guy because you'd been trained in Christianity and you were told that, well, here's this story of Jesus and this character, Simon, becomes the Pope after Jesus is gone. And so we should obey the current Pope because he's following in the lineage of Simon and he's Jesus's representative on the planet. And, I mean, it's a completely ludicrous, propaganda concept. But when you control all the media, and the Romans did at this time, and, they controlled the roads and the ideas and the books and everything, so all you could really do was study Jesus or learn about him, it worked for over 1,000 years. Europe was enslaved, and Christianity was the psychological tool that prevented rebellion.
What role, so Jesus basically said he did not come to bring peace but a sword. Does this explain kind of the nature of the empire of Christianity?
Yeah, I mean, that's just a little tongue-in-cheek comment on what's really in back of the Jesus character. There's all sorts of mysterious statements that he makes, which people come up with strange explanations for. The correct way to understand him is just as a Roman political psychological device, and you have to just sort of see the character as he existed within the first century when Rome is developing the religion. I mean, this character would have been absolutely perfect for the Romans to have come about. I mean, Jesus couldn't be better for the Romans if they invented him. He is advocating paying taxes. He is advocating, obeying Caesar and being pacifistic, not rebelling. And in the context of that statement, actually Jesus is really talking about violence against the Jews who are being wicked toward him. And so in the context of the statement of, I come with a sword, I mean, it's actually just a way so that people will not be upset by Roman violence against the rebellious Jews.
Where was ancient Judea as far as this empire?
Well,
to the best
of
your knowledge?
Rome was a collection of, it was a prison of nations at that point. They'd collected, dozens of ethnicities and little kingdoms and tribes. They'd conquered them all and had this kind of rough knit empire that was always having problems with rebellion because the ethnicities didn't like it. So But Judeo is very special because their religion would not permit graven images. And in the Roman Empire, you could have any religion you wanted. You could just, they didn't care, worship anybody. But you had to always permit the worship of Caesar. This was the sticking point. They thought that this was a really important political tool, that Caesar would be seen as a god by the conquered people. And so that was just an empire-wide requirement. Now, the Jews wouldn't accept this. They were the one group that wouldn't. And so they rebelled. And because of the rebellion, having this religious background to it, it was very troubling to Rome because at that point, their estimates of the Jewish population of the Roman Empire is high as 15%. Most of the estimates are 8, 9, 10%. But it was an enormous fraction of the population. And so Rome simply couldn't sit by and let these rebellions break out, particularly ones as violent as occurred in Judea, because in Judea, the Messianic movement was able to drive the Romans out and to establish its own nation state right in the middle of the Roman Empire at its very height. They actually established their own nation state right in the middle of it. Now, obviously, and Josephus, the historian, recorded this, they would have been concerned about the Jews throughout the empire beginning rebellions and then this spreading to other individuals. So this was, how serious the situation was in Judea at this time. Judea was really a very important focal point militarily to the Roman Empire. They had a very, very long-standing struggle against the Messianic movement, and you can see why they went to all the trouble to establish Christianity, that this Messianic movement represented a really powerful threat to them. And so they had a number of efforts. Christianity wasn't the first one. There was a number of efforts that the Roman Empire took upon itself to try to change Judaism. They were trying to secularize it, to make it less intolerant of Roman occupation. None of the prior efforts had worked, and so eventually Christianity got tried, and at the same time, the Romans were also doing everything they could to slaughter the individuals in the Messianic movement, and so eventually the combination of their warfare and new religion took hold, and they were able to then have what was known as the diaspora. They actually just removed the Jews physically from Judea, and that was really the end of that era of the struggle.
So they were pretty much badasses back then,
yeah,
the Jews.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, the religious fervor was very powerful and very successful. They were the only ones that were able actually to drive the Romans out for any period of time and establish a nation state. Just as an example, in, I think it was 115 approximately, there was another rebellion, and the Jews at that time were recorded as having killed every single Gentile on the island of Crete. And it was over, the historian recorded that there was 250,000 Gentiles that had been slaughtered by the Jews once they were able to get military control over them. So, and now beyond all this, the Jewish scripture has a lot of genocidal comments concerning the Gentiles, and so the Romans saw this literature as animating them. It was what was propelling them to rebel and then to be so ferocious in the warfare. So this was really what kind of was in back, I think, of the Christianity project, was the wars against the Jews, there was the first one started in the year one. Then there was chronic warfare up till 66, when just an absolute full-scale rebellion broke out and they drove Rome out. Rome then regained control of it, but there were still struggles. And in 115, led by the Jews in Alexandria, another rebellion occurred. And that time they have letters that they found which point out that the Jews actually drove the Roman forces out of Egypt. Can imagine this. This is the breadbasket of Rome. And there's a letter from a Roman magistrate who's trying to escape down the Nile to get away from the Jews. This was in the rebellion where they evidently slaughtered whole populations of Gentiles. And then you have the Bar Kokhba rebellion, 133. And at that time, again, the Jews drove the Romans out of Judea, set up a nation state, battled the legions to a standstill. It was the bloodiest battle that the Rome ever encountered. It was so bad that when the general who actually won finally the victory and defeated the Messianic movement in 135, he beat this Bar Kokhba character. The general, when they returned to Rome, you always give a salutation. This was the tradition of saying, you know, is Caesar well? And if Caesar is well, I am well and the troops are well. They didn't give the salutation that one time because so many families had lost sons in the war that they were afraid that the Roman population would rebel. So they simply didn't give the salutation for fear of the reprisal. So this was how violent and bloody these skirmishes were. And you see, this is the real context of Christianity. This is why if you don't have the right sort of historical understanding of the era, you just can't get how weird and unlikely Christianity was, because it's claiming to be this pacifistic religion from a Jewish Christ that emerges at a time when there's a messianic movement that's waging total war against the Roman Empire, and this is the national movement of the Jews at the time. So, you know, no matter how you cut it, it's just the religion is just you know, is much more easily understood as a psychological operation by Rome than it is as an organic religion that just sprung into existence.
And if you look at it, it almost looks like they went from the Old Testament, which you mentioned the Jews, and then the Gentiles back then. Can you explain it? Would the Gentiles be just basically anybody of a different race of Rome, and the Jews looked at them as a specific people and race as a chosen people?
I think that's an easy way to understand it from the perspective of the dialectic in the war. I mean, who's fighting against who? The Jews would have seen all of these individuals as Kittim, are you know, Gentiles. So they would have seen them as a group. They would have seen them as you know, racially distinct. But that was the position of the fundamentalists. The fact is that there was an enormous inbreeding between the populations, and which is kind of why when the Roman Caesars would see themselves as the Christ, they probably had, you know, some sort of genetic ability to make the claim. I mean, the family of Herod, which was a Greek family originally, to give you one example, they had been trying to breed a Christ. So what they did was they would take brides from the family that they had overthrown, the Maccabees, and then they would breed them to one of their family members, and then they would produce an offspring. They would train the kid in Rome for 20 years, bring him back to Judea and go, look, here's the legitimate ruler. He's got all the bloodlines. You see, he's the right character, you know.
So this would be an ancient priesthood bloodline?
Yeah, surely it was. Okay. Yeah, the Maccabees would have claimed themselves from Aaron and they would have claimed themselves to have been an ancient bloodline. But by breeding with these women, the Romans would have claimed that, look, we are their tax collecting family, the Herod. They say, look, we're the the correct, you know, messianic bloodline. It's not these rebellious people over here. It's us. The Rome attempted to confuse the issue as to who was the legitimate bloodline, and they did so, you know, with some, you know, there was some realism to their claim, because they, that family of Herod had actually been breeding with the Maccabees for generations. So, and then beyond this, the other wealthiest family in the world was the Alexanders, who were a famous Jewish family. In fact, their family produced Philo Alexander, who was by far the most famous Jewish intellectual of the first century. And this family had completely abandoned the Jewish religion and had aligned themselves with the Flavian Caesars. Tiberius Alexander, who was the head of the family at the time of the war, he actually referred to the Caesars as God, right? He'd abandoned Judaism to the extent that he was completely comfortable with the Roman imperial cult of worshiping a Roman Caesar as God. And then during the war, the Flavians made him the primary general against the Jews that were besieged in Jerusalem. So imagine this. The Romans have a Jew leading their troops who is from the most famous Jewish intellectual family of the century, right? So you can see that the, you know, the bloodlines and the theological claims, they're all just enmeshed within the political and military and financial issues. There's no separating them. And so the Romans had plenty of Jewish relatives. Titus Flavius, the individual who essentially is the son of man that Jesus predicts, his mistress in Rome was Bernice, who was a Maccabean. In other words, she was from the family of Herod, but she was a direct descendant of the Maccabees that had set up Eretz Israel with Judas Maccabee in you know, the second century BC. This was that was the purportedly fun, you know, legitimate messianic family, and yet one of their descendants then is the wife mistress of Titus Flavius. So the Caesars would, just as Alexander the Great had done, they would, you know, part of the colonization process would be to co-opt the royal families and the religions. That was just routine behavior of the invading ruler. And so there was a tremendous blurring of bloodlines and religion and things, and Christianity just comes right out of all that.
So the Greeks played a big role in this.
Well, Alexander the Great actually first conquered Judea, and it was the descendants of his general Seleucid were in control of Judea, and they were trying to Hellenize the region. They brought in what's called the gymnasium, where you had Greek athletics and intellectual instruction. The Greek language was spoken. Hebrew and Aramaic were probably spoken only by very few people. So Greek was Greece was essentially colonizing Judea and the Jews. And this was what the Maccabees rebelled against. The Maccabees were say 165 BCE, you know, they led a group of religious Jews against the Seleucids, because this group was wiping out their religion and culture by simply putting in this new culture that was absorbing so many Jews. So at that time, the Maccabees fought back. They had a rebellion. They would compulsorily circumcise anyone that they found in their region, Jew or Gentile. Once they would take over an area and occupy it, you had to be circumcised. So you can see that this was a really fundamental group, and they rebelled against the cultural absorption that had begun with Alexander the Great. And in fact, the family of Herod probably had direct family ties into those Greek ruling families that the Maccabees had deposed. The Romans attacked the Maccabees, they essentially, the family of Herod had gotten themselves placed into Judea as advisors, so-called, and they then exploited a battle or a rift between two Maccabees. They sided with one against the other, and then when they had defeated the Maccabee that was not allied with the Herods, at that point they brought in the Roman army. And that was the end, really, of the Jewish state that had been established by Maccabee. And so you can see again that there's this, you know, kind of longstanding cultural struggle that has religion as one of its primary components, and that it's the milieu that Christianity emerges from.
Yeah, and when you look at the story in Caesar's Messiah and the way you explain it, Joe, what I see is almost that there was a specific tribe or chosen family out of Judea that became part of the Roman Empire that they had chosen, and then they became like kind of the chosen family of the Roman Empire, and then everybody else was kind of like abolished and banished unless they joined with them under the banner of Christianity, and of course they didn't. They would get
that's
the sword.
A great explanation. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's, you know, it's really kind of funny because when you put Christianity in such a clear description as you've just given, you can see how obvious, you know, it all was, that everything really wasn't, you know, some kind of just once in a millennium, you know, bizarre circumstance. This is just the routine political struggle where, you know, you get a family essentially from the, you know, that is allied and trustworthy on a financial basis, because it's really money is, if you really want to know what's in back of Christianity, it's money. So the tax collectors for Rome, the Herods, they were struggling, trying to just keep everything together, battling against this messianic movement. But what was in back of all of it was just money. They were just, you know, making a fortune collecting these taxes and didn't want to give it up. And so they were perfectly willing to battle the messianic movement to the death in order to try to preserve the money that they were taking in.
And what role did the Byzantine Empire, they came
later? The families that are in back of the Byzantine Empire are the Flavians, Constantinople. Constantine's actual name is Flavius Constantine. And they don't have, good bloodline records to indicate that he was a member of the Flavian family, but I believe he was. And his divine arch, which is in Rome, aligned with the two prior Flavians, Titus and Vespasian. So it's clear he saw himself as having some kind of connection to the original Flavians who were first century. And he makes it the state religion. In my opinion, he's very familiar with sort of the reasons why Christianity had been developed. At that point, they've been able to see the religion in operation for more than a century, so they knew it produced a kind of docility in its adherence, and this would have been exactly what they were looking for. They were, when Constantine went to establish the feudal system, which was going to be a perpetual and eternal enslavement of the European mind, basically. When he went to establish it, he had a long-standing sort of family background in Christianity and knew that it was a winner in terms of producing, a very obedient peasant. So this was what, Europe, or the European individuals, you know, were up against. They were up against a very sophisticated group who had been studying mind control, how to control populations for generations. And they were able to concoct Christianity and finally get it established as both the state religion and as a as an effective mind control apparatus, so that peasants would stop rebelling. I mean, when you just think of the known and not controversial in any way role that Christianity played in the feudal system. Boy, it sure is suspicious. The feudal system was a slave system that existed for more than 1,000 years. And in every one of those years, ruler of it, the actual hierarchy, was the Pope. He was actually the highest point within the feudal system. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the first principle of trying to understand history is to follow money. And in this case, it's just completely obvious that Christianity had been established as part of the controlling apparatus of the feudal system.
No, I agree, Joe. And when you look at it, when they basically Christianized certain areas, they would, you know, kind of domesticate these people. And a lot of them were raised as warriors. So I believe kind of the old culture that they had created before Christianity and, you know, 2,000 years ago, I'm talking 3,000-4,000 years ago, was basically a warrior from birth to death. And then part of that created a beast across the world. Yeah. And then the Roman Empire looked to, you know, they were part of course, this culture as well. I mean, you could look at the Roman Empire, then they implemented Christianity as a kind of that mind control method that you talked about. And then when they implemented it in places like England and Britain, what happened is the populations became so passive and peaceful that they were still easily taken over by barbarian nations, such as, you know, the Scandinavians, they called them the Vikings, which were non-Christians at the time. So they would come and just annihilate them, which they did several times. And again, I know that's not part of Caesar's Messiah, but what are your thoughts, you know, on the Vikings and their role in Christianity? Because they eventually joined too.
I have actually kind of wondered the same thing, is that the European mind just became enslaved. And when you imagine, you know, 5th century through 11th century European peasantry, they were putting up with a system of slavery that was just an absolute monolith. There was nothing else in their existence but Christianity and obedience to the state. And you wonder, you know, there are some rebellions that are recorded, but really very few relative to, you know, the circumstance that they were facing. So, you know, just a natural question is how the hell were they able to, you know, the keep these people from rising up time after time when they had such barbaric, such demonic control over them? Well, it's as you say, they must have really produced a kind of numb, broken-minded docility in the Christians during this era, and that was how they were able to, keep the political and enslavement system working. Is that they must have really understood clearly how to control populations with religion, and so when the Vikings show up, it's no surprise that the populations couldn't defend themselves. I mean, they had been completely their soul, their spirit had been eviscerated by the Roman Empire. So, you know, when we look at our history, Europeans, you know, when we look at our history, we have to wonder to what extent have we sort of lost our way emotionally because of the devastating effects of Christianity. It certainly was the case, you know, in the Middle Ages that we had completely succumbed and just couldn't resist. So my question is, well, what are the residues. What do we have now that we are still under the influence of this device? You know, we think that we're free. You know, I mean, well, are we really? What effect has all of this had on us? And what would really our spirit be like if we had not been enslaved and had not been subjected to this, a millennium of mind control?
Yeah, it's a kind of a double-edged sword there, because you look back, again, I know you're a big scholar and historian, and I've been studying history too, along with the scriptures, and you look back at past history, and it was a brutal, brutal history that we have for thousands and thousands of years, and then here we are, you, Joe, in beautiful Santa Barbara. I'm down here in Southern California in beautiful Carlsbad, a mile from the beach, and we're talking freely about what we feel and from our hearts to people across the world, where not too long ago people would have been killed for these words. And I know the people that would have brought it on usually. And do you think that this same brotherhood, this same network, this apparatus is still in control of the world?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think that the sort of political meaning of Caesar's Messiah is that rulers have techniques for mind control that are far more sophisticated than perhaps we have been led to believe. And so, because obviously there's a political context to my work. And so I always, when I am asked directly, what would be the advice that would have been worthwhile from the perspective of your work, to all of these people whose lives were destroyed by the feudal system, what would you have said? Is there anything that you could have said that would make a difference? And I always say the same thing. I say, look, what I would have suggested as having been useful would have been to do DNA testing on the families that claimed to be the ruling class of Christianity. Because if you'd done that, what you would have seen is, in fact, that they aren't, a kind of random collection of religious individuals. It's just a big family. And if people had seen that, then they would know that this wasn't a religion at all. It was an enslavement device, right? So that information, the actual just knowing who the people were related to, would have given a completely clear understanding of the actual reality of what had gone on. Now, in that era, they couldn't do those tests. Those tests were just mechanically impossible. The technology hadn't been developed. But they have now. In other words, so given the fact that it is clear that the ruling populations are using very sophisticated, mind control devices, as far back as Christianity, very sophisticated, very, very well thought out mind control devices. Citizens would be really well advised to make sure that the claims that the people who come forward as rulers make about themselves are true. I mean, are they really just a random group of individuals that have some different perspectives, and therefore end up having wars, from time to time, or is something else going on? And so the only way you could really be sure about that would be to do those tests. And I think that given that in the 20th century, I'm trying to think. I mean, I try to get the number, and it's different every time I look it up, but it's somewhere between, 100 and 220 million people were slaughtered by themselves, right? That they brought about their own deaths under control and orders of these political rulers. Given that, I would say that the citizens really are entitled to make absolutely sure that we're not somehow victims of some kind of sophisticated mental techniques that the oligarchs have come up with. And the test that I advocate wouldn't cost a lot of money. It is very easy to do, wouldn't take any sort of time. And if I'm wrong, fine. But if I'm right, then the populations would have a completely clear understanding of what our reality is, you see. So I would love to see such tests done. And frankly, the experience that, you know, you can imagine I've had with Caesar's Messiah has made me very suspicious. I really, when I look at political events that are, you know, things that the government gives us that are acts of terror, supposedly, I'm very troubled and suspicious by these things. And I think that the way to get to the bottom of it would be to do the test that I suggest.
And it seems like the powers that be are doing that themselves on the populations with the genome project. Do you know, have any knowledge
on
that?
Only that it's you know, this kind of information is very troubling. I mean, if you think about like the NSA, and you know, they have this explanation as to why they're creating all these listening devices. Well, you know, let's just for the sake of argument accept them. The problem is that we know from just historical fact that oftentimes evil people take over the reins of government. This just happens all the time. And if there were evil individuals that were controlling this technology, how would the citizens ever be able to get them out of power? Because they could just sit there and listen to every single thing we say. And of course, with big data, they now have these precog capacities where they can study, you know, Google, you know, propensities and determine, you know, who would be a likely terrorist, you know. So this kind of technology in the wrong hands is catastrophic. It will lead to, you know, massive extermination of population and really ossify slavery and oligarchic control. And so because it's so powerful and because it has the potential to last forever, it should only be even permitted to exist with just absolutely, you know, ironclad types of control that it couldn't ever get into the wrong hands. But at the moment, I don't see any of that. And so, you know, as far as what is occurring at the present time, I don't think I have any better information than anyone else. But the experience that I've had with the research in Caesar's Messiah has really made me nervous. And I don't trust government whatsoever. It appears that the temptations of the delight of power are just so overwhelming that they have developed techniques far more sophisticated than I could have imagined. And I, you know, just flat out do not want to see this kind of technologic power given to groups that may never want to give it up. So, you know, it's a troubled situation, and you know, I don't want to try to you know, try to make too paranoid a comment, but I just really am worried about it and don't believe the current I am skeptical of everything that is being told to us at this point, and would hope that citizens will be alert to the possibility of tyranny, because the powers that they have created, imagine if Caesars held those. There never would have been a Renaissance. There never would have been a Reformation. The feudal system would still be going really strong, and you wouldn't like your life. In fact, your life wouldn't even exist, because, you know, at one point, the oligarch could look out onto the fields and see the happy vision of all of his slaves producing product for him. Well, that doesn't exist any longer. You know, the robots have more or less taken the place of all of this. You talk about the food banks or the genome projects. I mean, so they can breed for the kinds of populations they want. And they, in my opinion, would look at, you know, the welfare state and just the temptation to say, you know, why am I wasting all of my money on these useless individuals, right? In the old days, the serf had a function, but now it just doesn't exist any longer. And so the serf is really simply a danger to the oligarch, because he must sit there and go, you know, what if these people want to rebel at some point? And so that's why I think that, you know, the citizens would be, again, just really well advised to be exceptionally wary right now. And paranoia is not a bad thing from time to time. And I would say this is a good moment to be really, really careful of the kinds of power that are being developed by the government, because they don't seem to be in good control and would be so powerful that they would lead to a perpetual slave state, and of course to massive population reductions once the government was able to get the control that it wanted.
It seems like you already see that happening right now, that even though I know, Joe, you're saying that this is something you see happening in the future, it's actually happening now, and I know you know that. And it's interesting that we are talking on a thing that they call the web, and I always say you don't surf a web, you get caught in it. Uh-huh. So, you know, yeah, and I look at it as a government's, you know, wet dream, you know, the truth. It's something that, you know, to be honest with you, I make my living off of it right now. I do a lot of my communications and spend about 10 hours on here. It's the best place to gather information.
Sure.
And I know you probably know that, Joe, in getting information for your books. So it's an interesting world that we live in. And I agree that people need to look around and see that the pyramids are built, that the capstone, I think they're just waiting to put it on top. And all these people that helped build the pyramid, there's really no need for them anymore, as they're dancing on the deck of the Titanic as it seems like it's going down.
Yeah, you know, I would not be telling the truth if I claimed to be sort of in opposition to that idea. I do see the chance, and I think the reality of population reduction on a large scale that's essentially going on right now. You know, hard to know how it will play out, but in my opinion, you know, I just see very little chance that that the oligarchs are not sort of organizing their technology for a perpetual slave state. I think it would be almost unwise of them to do anything else, and you know, the citizens, those of us that live here in this world, we just need to use the internet while it's available, because it won't be forever. But while it's available, we should be making advantage of it. And the way we do that is by giving information. And you're really commended on the information that you bring out, the different ideas, alternative ideas. You know, it's just, this is the first time that media is really in the control of the populations. You know, it's always been in the control of the oligarchs from day one till the internet really came about. And now we are able to essentially create our own understanding of reality. We don't need to sit there and just accept what Fox News tells us. We can actually do our own research, find out our own truths, and then share that information. It isn't just abstract. It's stuff we can actually bring, to our friends and to the general population. And so while we have this opportunity, we should make use of every single second, every single second. And we should create a very much more informed and alert citizenry. And so that means we have to, you know, show them the basis for paranoia and show them how to think clearly to be able to defend themselves against tyranny. So this is, in my opinion, it's a very critical moment. And those of us like yourself who are actually helping to like create new ideas and new ways of looking at things are just doing the most important work imaginable.
Is there a way to work and meet a middle ground with the powers that be where, you know, we could, I mean, right now we're distributing the truth and the knowledge and so forth. And is there a way that we could be part of this society in the future, or what do you see for us as far as the citizenry say here in America?
I think that unless there is a change of political structure, the citizens will be exterminated.
That's plain and simple.
Yeah. There might be, you know, if they can do it humanely, just with ways of making population, you know, a birth control, things like this, they can take a long-standing approach to it, or they could do it more violently because they would be afraid of rebellion or whatever reason they would have. But, you know, if they have as complete a control over government as I suspect, I mean, they can just do it any way they damn well want at this point. So,
but if you look at us, like say here in America, it looks like a lot of the things that are placed in our system, it's almost like a free will type of system where people can kind of choose, you know, whatever they want at free will. And a lot of people are making the wrong choices as far as what they eat, what they put into their bodies and so forth that are kind of speeding this up, you know, the cancers and so forth. And I feel a lot of it is the food and the smoking.
God,
and,
you just couldn't, you know, I mean, our environment. I always hate to do this because I just go off on a rant, and it starts out, particularly since my ideas about Christianity are eccentric. But then when you get me into the food, I mean, but it's all part of the same analysis. It's when you see the oligarchic control and how, you know, clever they are in terms of shaping population and reducing population, you just have to automatically look at things like the gender-bending hormones that are in clothes and wonder if, in fact, you know, this is actually a kind of a very subtle way of creating birth control. Certainly, the sperm counts of Europeans are, dramatically lower than they were, in 1900. I don't think anyone disputes those numbers. And so, was there awareness of this as these processes occurred? Boy, I would just be astounded if there wasn't. I would not believe that. I would say, no, that's not possible. They are aware of this, and in fact, that suggests that they're bringing them about. And, example of this that I've been recently focused on is the counterculture that occurred in the 60s, late 60s. It is, in my opinion, just as clear as a bell that this was a complete government operation, that the LSD and the rock and roll bands and what became known as kind of the archaic revival were all actually implemented to essentially dumb down and mentally debase the baby boomers. And I know this just, you know, to someone who isn't familiar with this concept, this seems just almost paranoid or completely paranoid. But the fact is that there is a book called Weaponizing Anthropology by an anthropologist named Dr. David Price, and he shows that there are letters written by Gregory Bateson, who was Margaret Mead's husband and a OSS and CIA anthropologist, that describes experiments that had been done by the Russian population, by the Russian authorities, which determined how best to control inferior populations. And the way that this could be done most simply was by having them embrace the past. So, you know, it's a rather long piece of analysis, but just in general, I mean, Bateson's letter says that, you know, if you want to really enslave someone, you need to take them away from modernization, because if they do that, they're just going to want the technology that the enslaving culture has. So you really want them to get into dance and music. And in the case of the experiments that he was advocating, also taking drugs, because this tribe, the Asiatic tribes in Siberia, who were related to the Eskimo, had the psilocybin mushroom, And I actually have the Bateson's letter here in front of me, so I'm just going to read it so you can see that I'm not exaggerating. Bateson wrote, "The most significant experiment which has been conducted in the adjustment of relations between superior and inferior people is the Russian handling of their Asiatic tribes in Siberia. The findings of this experiment support very strongly the conclusion it is important to foster a native revival among the enslaved populations." Okay, now Bateson then goes on and develops what's called this MKUltra program, which basically is studying how to control people and produces LSD. But you have a guy named Gordon Wasson, who then is famous for having been the very first person to bring the psychedelic mushroom experience to the American population. This really began the drug culture, when Life magazine did an article that on the cover described these wonderful visions and things that Wasson had. And then years later, it turns out that Wasson had been employed by this same organization, this MKUltra, right? Which then is outed in the, I believe it was the early 80s by the Church Commission. And in that time, they admitted that they had given LSD to a number of Americans without their knowing it. These experiments were done primarily in San Francisco, right? And including in this was the dosing of an entire French village just to see what the effect would be. They claimed they were trying to study how the Soviet Union might, attack our populations. But anyway, so now you go forward and you have, Ken Kesey with his bus, with further on all these bright colors, giving LSD to children. He worked for MKUltra. Right, Kesey worked for MKUltra. The band that he promotes is this Grateful Dead band. Robert Hunter, who was their lyricist, he works for MKUltra. Now, the LSD is being made by this guy, Osley Stanley. I don't know if you're old enough to remember Purple Osley, but this was the standard LSD dose of that began the whole thing. Well, Osley had spent 2 years at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. He somehow, for some reason, checked himself in for 2 years, which was where MKUltra was doing the experiments on how LSD and psilocybin could affect people for mind control. So finally, you end up with like Terence McKenna, who is sort of the final kind of guru of the whole thing. And he's describing the whole thing as the drug taking and this removing, of people from technological culture as a native revival, right? It's full circle back to Bateson. So when you look at all of these government links into the counterculture, what it seems to me is that they wanted to try to begin to establish a retrograde population to control. And this could be called neo-feudalism, right? Neo-feudalism. They wanted to really start to begin a neo-feudalistic state. Now, where I got involved in all this whole thing was, I was very interested in neo-Christianity. See, there was a book called A Course in Miracles that these two guys, man and woman, William Thetford and I believe Helen Schumann wrote. And in A Course in Miracles, Schumann claims to be channeling the words of Jesus Christ. And it's a slightly different philosophy than the first, information that Jesus is reported to give in the Gospels. So I was really interested in that. I go, gee whiz, neo-Christianity. And then I started investigating Schumann and Thetford. And lo and behold, just an amazing circumstance, they were employees of MKUltra when she was supposedly channeling Jesus Christ. And she is, at that time, a psychometrician working for the CIA project to determine, what influences could control groups, right? So when I look at these dots, when I look at these data points, I don't have any confusion at all. It looks to me like the government was taking a generation into a debased condition. They had had anthropologic experiments giving them a kind of science so that they knew better what they were doing than the Caesars did. And they even, as a capstone, had neo-Christianity. So I wrote an article called Manufacturing the Deadhead with a guy named Jan Ervin, and it's on the web in case anyone wants to read it. But I don't think the conclusions, frankly, can be contested. I think that the counterculture was, in fact, a government operation, and it was done with the idea of enslavement. So if you accept that analysis, right, sorry to be long-winded here, but if you accept that analysis, getting back to your points, you know, what is the future of the population? Well, I'll tell you, it's not very bright, because this means that if you would do something like this, that you don't have any human empathy for a certain class of citizens. As far as you're concerned, give them drugs, kill them, anything you want. They're like animals. So if this is actually the mindset that is in control of, you know, these elements of government, then we've got a real problem.
No, I agree, Joe. I'm an ex-alcoholic and drug addict, and I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, and I was actually the counterculture of punk rock, yeah, which came after that, and I definitely did a lot of damage to myself. One of the first tattoos I got when I was 13 was Live Fast, Die Young. So that's kind of the culture of punk rock. Not all of it was like that, but the majority of it was that. I mean, our dance was to slam into each other and jump off stages.
Yeah.
You know, I've almost been beaten to death at concerts. I've been in plenty of fights. I've broken my nose twice, almost broken my neck off a stage. So I definitely know what you're talking about. But in the same breath, there's also the other side of the coin there, is that I chose to do that. I wasn't forced to. It was kind of something I was drawn to. So I believe that it's not good, you know, that these things are being manufactured and they're in control by the government. Then I also believe it's better than, you know, just having a sword and we're living in, you know, the sixth century, and we're living in complete darkness, and there's no knowledge or gnosis or anything for us, you know, us Gnostics, which I feel like you, Joe, are an independent thinker, you know, that we could choose to do. So I think we're blessed somewhat to live in this time, even though these are some
Absolutely.
Dark times. I mean, there is some light in them as well.
We have a fighting chance because we have active minds. The surf, and if you look at our background, right, it was black. And I mean, there was just no intellectual light whatsoever. There were 1,000 years of European peasants, our ancestors, that didn't have, as far as one can tell, a thought in their mind. They had been put to sleep over generations and generations. So now, as we're having this conversation, these insights into the political power above us are things that are absolutely precious, because they are lights which can lead to freedom and to a future. So we have to be very careful how we use them, and we have to, you know, have the energy of self-defense and preservation of life. You know, we need to bring our full powers to the problem of how to make sure that we aren't simply slaughtered by tyrants. So, you know, and I was certainly a victim of the counterculture. You know, I took drugs that should never have been available to me, and were attractive because of influences to my mind that were evil, that were deliberate, you know, that they were taking advantage of someone who was you know, a young person who didn't have, you know, a way to escape. I mean, you look at the Beatles, you know, I mean, you know, they start out as so lovable, you know, I want to hold your hand, and then you end up, you know, with Sergeant Pepper, with Aleister Crowley on the cover, and all of these brilliant colors, but it's all about drug taking, you see. And so, you know, they change culture incrementally. It's the only way they can do it. It has to be very slow. You don't notice it. If you notice it, then it's too abrupt and it doesn't have as much power. So when they get to the punk movement, they've had a background of a generation of debased music, debased music stars, pop idols. They've normalized drug use. And so someone of your age coming into that was entering into a culture that was a death machine and had been designed to destroy you and weaken you, you know, weaken you and then destroy you. And so the fact that you got out the other side is to your credit, and the, you know, the wisdom that you've experienced, you've gained through the experience now can really be valuable in you helping the younger generation and in informing your own generation about what we're facing, what the so-called events we see in the media, they actually are. And I just for a second wanted to rant about food. I mean, you know, you can just through the wrong foods poison yourself so badly you can't even think clearly, you know?
No, I agree. And I think organic food is crucial if you could afford it out there to eat it.
Yeah, just don't take any synthetic oils. If you look in on a package of so-called food and the ingredient list is longer than one, just put it away. And of course, you know, things that are artificial like white sugar and all that other stuff, just is this insane to eat that stuff. It just is a death sentence. So, you know, you need to have your energy. These are dangerous times. You know, I don't really, in my personal world, I don't see the financial crisis as ever ending. I don't think we're ever going to experience a really powerful upticking economy, because I don't think it's in the oligarchs' interest. I think they know exactly what they're doing and where they're taking us. And impoverishing us makes us obviously easier to control. So that's just one thing to have in mind, is you need to have a financial perspective of self-defense, you know, of how to manage money, how to retain wealth, what money is, you know. And so, you know, we're kind of suffering from the leftover effects of the feudal system, you know, and of course with the modern acceleration, you know, the feudal system had Christianity and, you know, some kinds of mind control. Well, now they've got rock and roll music. And just as another example, look at all of the dozens of these survivor type shows that are on TV now. There are literally dozens of them. You know, 20 years ago, there were none. But now you turn on the TV set and you see, you know, naked survivors, man, women survivors, dual survivors. And then you have really barbaric concepts like Duck Dynasty, you know, everything is retrograde. It's making old cars shiny again, pawn shops. They're definitely trying to put the ideas embracing the past, a more primitive life, in the minds of the population, in my opinion, because it's obvious that they're going to give us that existence. They're putting the ideas out now with the idea that that will normalize and you'll accept them more easily when the grid goes down, when there is no electricity, you know, when you have to make your own fire, you know. So the understanding of history and you know, a really good place to start is coming through the punk movement. I mean, I commend you for making it out the other side of that disaster. That's a really good place to start as to, you know, how to understand what we're dealing with, you know, and, you know, just one thing, don't be depressed. Don't ever think, oh, this is horrible. You know, what a terrible circumstance. Look, the American dream is well named. It is a dream. It's not real. We are always in a food chain. Power is always in being contested. Always. It doesn't matter. It just always does. You have to be alert and you have to develop your own power. And it starts, in our case, with developing community. We are so unorganized against the organization of the oligarchs. So I always, you know, say, look, if any of the ideas we're discussing make any sense to you, if it's a better description of your reality somehow than what you get on Fox News or CNN, then find someone that you can share it with. And then the two of you find somebody else, and then the three of you find a group, and then try to organize the group to expand politically. And there's many different ways that political energy can move, and different, you know, forms it can take. You don't have to try to immediately, you know, have some impact on the congressional race. You know, you just need to develop community. And inside those communities, and I've actually been lucky enough to have been led into, you know, some people trying to organize themselves, you can find real moral direction, you know. And I know that it sounds like, well, it's you know, it doesn't sound like much fun, but actually you can get a clarity of how to live, you know, when you're with people who can honestly talk about these things with, when you can obviously share your concerns, and you then can also try to develop brotherhood that will enable you to share the financial problem. Because if you have slight degrees of organized, you know, kind of techniques that relate to financial structures, you can, as a group, make much more progress. Individuals, very hard to get started, hard to get capital, hard to know how to manage capital. You know, the ideas are sometimes, you know, hit and miss. Just try to find groups that can share these ideas, and then try to find a way to make a living that is not dependent on the vagaries of government. Something that you can really control and have some ability to pass on to your children.
Yeah, because in this world, money is freedom, and especially with Obamacare coming, right, and all those other feudal systems we could go on about. I just have a couple more questions before you go today, Joe. If you were Caesar, Titus, the bishop of the world, what would you do? The pyramid's built, everything's done, all your work, you see it is pretty much a done deal, but you have a few billion slaves that you need to take care of, and you don't know what to do with. What would you do?
You know, the Caesars were motivated by glory and legacy. I mean, they had, you know, all the slaves and wealth, they had everything. But all they really wanted was legacy. That's really why they put the crazy typology, which is what I, you know, have discovered in the Gospels. You know, what they created this weird character, the Son of Man, that Jesus is envisioning. And, you know, they did it so that later on people would know that they were geniuses and had the ability to make this fake Christianity. And so that kind of motivates people, I think, a lot when they're young. The Caesars actually, you know, or like Titus was in his 30s, you know. I'm in my 60s, I'm a parent, and I'm kind of at the point where, it's really as important to me that to share and to have communication as it is to have power. And so just as an old guy, I would really try to use, if power had ever come to me, I would try to use it to set up a structure whereby there would be education.
Plato's Republic.
I would really try to make, I would not want to see an oligarchic, structure go forward into history. And so to really stop that, you just have to promote education. And so in the Middle Ages, the wealthy families would have their children trained in what was called the trivium and quadrivium, and basically it was just grammar and logic. And I think if we ever have a world ruler that wants to make sure that his legacy is the clear-mindedness, of the populations in the future, that'll be someone we can really honor dramatically, because that would be something that could last forever. And so that's what I'd do. I'd set up the the pedagogy that would start children in understanding logic principles and grammar, how logic and grammar interact, and I would do it for everyone.
That's a great answer.